If you'd like to receive this podcast early and without ads, consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Listeners to this show can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience and early access, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our episodes via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for select podcasts, and an invitation to join the DSR Slack community. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code DAILYBLAST to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code DAILYBLAST. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, March 23rd, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. Over the weekend, Donald Trump delivered a speech at a rally in Ohio that was one of his most unhinged and dangerous performances yet. He used appallingly dehumanizing language about migrants, saluted January 6th rioters as patriots and heroes, and predicted a bloodbath if he loses the election. On today's show, we're talking with Susan Glasser, a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of an excellent new piece about Trump's use of language at rallies like this one. Glasser urges us to watch Trump's performances at length to appreciate the full threat to democracy he poses, and closes with this warning: don't look away. We're really glad to have you on today, Susan.
Greg, thanks so much for having me.
So your piece is largely about Trump's language at his rally last week in Georgia. The piece is only a few days old, yet Trump has already managed to outdo that. But before we get to Ohio, what is it about Trump's Georgia rally that alarmed you so much?
Well, in a way, what's alarming is just that it's another Saturday in the life of Donald Trump and this extraordinary campaign that defies our ability to wrap our arms around it, I think, in many ways. And so what's amazing is that he's so succeeded in many ways in desensitizing us collectively to the enormity of the outrages that he peddles, that it actually benefits him, I believe. And we sort of, those who aren't his super fans, look away. I understand that, by the way. Apologies in advance. I'm not, you know, recommending that this is a, you know, uplifting or a positive kind of thing to do with your time. But in terms of understanding the election and why is it, you know, we all see these polls, this extraordinary numbers of people who have somehow forgotten what Trump was really like as president or willfully deceived themselves, or they just don't want to engage with it. They don't want to pay attention. It's important because it's quite shocking, actually, if you just open your mind and sit there and listen. Again, apologies in advance, but this is an hour and 55 minutes of an extraordinary torrent of not just the same old lies, but a new set of lies and untruths and misdirection meant to frame this moment. And I think it's very, very shocking to experience that anew.
Absolutely. And I think it's challenging for the media. And that's one of the things I really liked about your piece. You really raised two important points in tandem. First, you say that Trump's rally comments are very hard to distill into conventional news stories. And second, you say that watching Trump's rallies at some length really opens a window on the threat he poses to American democracy. Those things seem connected, right? What's hard to distill into conventional news stories is the kind of sum total of the effect at these rallies and the sum total of their meaning. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, that's right. It's interesting. So I was just on this TV show this morning on ABC, and it's very interesting. I was on with a former Trump administration official, one of the many who's turned on him, right? So she's not like a, you know, Trump supporter now, but, you know, it's still, especially here in Washington, my view is that our conventions, we tend to over-prioritize policy discussions and policy disputes. That's, again, understandable, right? Why do people come to Washington? They're interested in policy. Also, Democrats in general, you know, where it's a kind of a technocratic party in many ways, right? You know, we believe in the idea of government, and therefore we're going to kind of talk about how to make it work better. But, you know, we're talking about this Trump rally. And she said, well, he's really talking about tariffs on China. That's the bigger outrage than, you know, his bloodbath comment. And I actually, I disagree with that. I don't think that, I think that he benefits when conventional Republicans, even those Republicans who don't like him, they want to revert to safe space of talking about, well, here's this policy, or, well, he wasn't really that bad, you know, on foreign affairs in his first term, so it'll be okay. Things like that. What he's selling is this overall picture. He's selling an authoritarian vision of this strongman leader himself, who's going to, you know, his policy platform for 2024 is essentially, elect me your magical solution to all problems, whether it's the war between Russia and Ukraine, which will, according to him, just instantly end when he becomes the president. The problems at the border, he'll just, you know, arrest gajillions of people and boom, poof, that'll be over. And, you know, that's the kind of language that, you know, I'm more familiar from my time as a foreign correspondent, hearing Vladimir Putin say, don't listen to anyone except for me. I'm the only one that matters. That's an actual Putin quote after his invasion of Ukraine. And of course, that's what Trump is selling in this 2 hours of rambling, bizarre discourse. So it's no one particular thing. It's in an entire alternate reality worldview.
So let's talk about the latest in Ohio. Trump attacked the idea that we've renamed forts named after Confederates. He called the January 6th rioters hostages and renewed his vow to release them or pardon them. He called migrants arrested for crimes not people. And he predicted a quote-unquote bloodbath for our country if he's not elected this fall, though it's possible he was talking partly about the auto industry. Here's a short clip.
And you're not going to be able to sell those guys if I get elected. Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
So in your piece, you raise an interesting question. You noted that Biden recently gave his State of the Union speech, which some observers pointed out was quite harshly critical of his predecessor, i.e. Trump. But then you asked, imagine if the two speeches were covered side by side. That really applies to this Ohio speech. Can you talk about why we should do that comparison?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was really struck when I was working on my column. I read a piece by Karl Rove, columnist in the Wall Street Journal, of course, the famous strategist for George W. Bush. Again, another Republican who is not a huge fan of Donald Trump. And he's not cheerleading for him. And to me, that's what it made it so interesting, because this is a technique that I found for many conservative, even critics of Trump. They're just on so much more familiar and safer territory, understandably, in many ways. They want to talk about Biden. They want to talk about the Democrats. They want to have a more conventional policy conversation. And in a way, this actually helps to enable the Trump phenomenon, because then you have this column from Rove dinging Joe Biden. He literally said he lowered himself. He debases the presidency by referring. He never, Biden, in that State of the Union speech, it was a very partisan speech, very different than many State of the Union addresses I've heard. But pulling back, he 13 times in that speech over the course of a little bit more than an hour referred to, quote, my predecessor in criticizing kind of either Trump policies or the threat that he posed in a more general sense. He never referred to Trump specifically by name. The Washington Post, by contrast, the fact checker, went ahead and looked at Trump's Georgia rally just a few days after Biden's speech, 5 dozen references to Biden, not only by name, but of course, the harshest, most puerile epithets, stupid, angry, dumb, vicious, criminal, crooked, you know, and on and on and on. And so, again, it's the juxtaposition, I think, that really is very telling about the state of our politics right now. And I should say this as somebody who believes that, you know, our job as journalists is not to create some kind of hierarchy of threats that causes people who are very worried about Donald Trump to provide uncritical coverage of Joe Biden or the presidency. I think that's a mistake. I absolutely think that, you know, Biden and the country is owed a critical, free-thinking, independent media, and that that's how the system has to work. But you know what? Listen, we're all capable of walking and chewing gum, right? And we can, you know, understand that Hillary Clinton's emails are not the same level of threat to the democracy as Donald Trump. That doesn't mean that Democrats have free license to, you know, take classified documents home and do whatever they're doing. It's one of the sort of most annoying, I think, running tropes of this era. But just to the rallies, I think that juxtapose these two things. In my view, the choice becomes manifestly clear. Right now, Trump is only speaking to fanatic groups of his super fans, and everybody else is tuning him out. And they better stop tuning him out.
Right. Trump is actually explicitly saying he only wants MAGA. He's telling everyone else to get lost, including Nikki Haley supporters and those types of Republicans. I think the basic point you open the door on is this, if I could try to frame it. The media institutionally knows how to cover a Biden speech, right? His State of the Union might have been unusually partisan, but he still remained within the boundaries of what media figures tend to think of as the boundaries of acceptable discourse. It's mostly pretty conventional stuff, but Trump's language is overtly authoritarian. It expressly dehumanizes. It treats the January 6th rioters who tried to violently overthrow U.S. democracy as patriots and victims. It even adopts like an almost totalitarian up is down kind of propaganda approach. Trump calls his opponents thugs and fascists, but scholars in fascism point out that he's using tropes that carry threats of political violence and are really pretty arguably fascistic language. So your line about comparing them side by side to me means let's demonstrate that fundamental difference. Is that the task before us in essence?
Yeah, I mean, I think as journalists, that comparison is a very important and valid one. And it is absolutely a struggle. We are 8 years into this Trump phenomenon in American politics since he entered the race back in 2015. And, you know, we've gone through every cycle of cover him, don't cover him, whatever. I'm not saying that there's an answer, but I was really struck as somebody who has covered the Trump phenomenon from the beginning, who wrote an entire, you know, 400 plus page book on the Trump presidency with my husband, Peter Baker, the divider. And yet I was really struck just to actually sit down and listen to the full 2 hours of kind of hate speech flow over you. And I heard some new things. And I'm glad you've repeatedly pointed out this January 6th thing. Rather than January 6th spelling an end to Donald Trump's political career, he has just a few years later transformed this event into the core of his campaign platform. And that is a remarkable and striking thing, which apparently many Americans are not familiar with. Well, they should get familiar with the idea that Donald Trump, not only is he not taking any responsibility for the attack on the legitimacy of the election and his own calling forth of this attack on the Capitol in the first place, but putting aside even his own culpability, which may or may not ever find its way to a court of law anytime soon. But nearly 2,000 of his supporters have been arrested, tried, convicted, many of them in cases for storming their own Capitol, for violently attacking the Capitol in the effort to shut down Congress in its constitutional duty of certifying the election. Donald Trump is saying that these people are heroes and martyrs. He is explicitly running against the rule of law. Those are not kangaroo courts in America, but he is trying to say that they are. And I just feel like that, of course, is something new that we didn't have in 2016 or 2020. So it's something very important and significant. The other thing is there's a whole new way that he is framing and talking about what is the state of the country right now. And it is so scary and delusional. And the words that he uses about the incumbent president of the United States are something that are so outside of the bounds of any political rhetoric I've ever heard from a major party candidate in this country, including Trump in 2016 and 2020. Trump is now accusing Joe Biden directly of murder. He is now accusing Joe Biden of literally being the criminal mastermind behind letting into this country and directing the actions of rampaging gangs of murderous thugs and criminals. In his Ohio rally just last night, he was using language about migrants that goes even beyond the outrageous claims of, you know, criminality or you know, the rapists that he talked about back in 2015. Now he basically is denying the personhood of people who are trying to come into the United States illegally. This is, again, you want to talk about the language of tyrants and dictators. One of the kind of rule book number one for leaders like this is to call your opponents scum, non-humans, subhumans. And this is what we're openly hearing from Donald Trump in March of the election year. So yeah, like people should wake up to that.
Yep. And by the way, he used the word vermin, which is very much in the lexicon that you're talking about there. I was really interested in what you said about how this is a struggle for all of us. I mean, you've been around the DC media for some time. You founded Politico magazine, worked for many years at the Washington Post, now at the New Yorker. I think all of us in the media probably are still struggling with how to cover a Trump rally. Why is this so hard to get right?
Well, because we're used to living in a democracy in which there are constraints and guardrails and norms and rules of the road. And if you have not only a candidate, but a political party that has become radicalized and is essentially using those rules and norms and laws against the democracy itself. Again, it's not unprecedented. So we do have some recent modern experience if you look at countries in which the democracy itself has been essentially hijacked by an extremely, you know, potent minority. And it is a minority. Let's be clear on that. You know, it's a very divided country between Democrats and Republicans, almost evenly divided. But the MAGA part of the Republican Party is ascendant, but it's still a minority of a minority in the country. And yet we've seen that you can take over a whole country using its own institutions. And so how do you fight back against that? Well, the optimal scenario, right, is that the party that gave us Donald Trump, right, should have rejected him. That hasn't happened. In fact, he's had a very remarkably successful takeover of the GOP. And we have such a two-party system. It's ingrained in how we do politics in the country. It's ingrained in our election laws and everything. And so that's a tremendous advantage for someone like Trump who is willing to disregard rules and laws that are not convenient for him. So I think that's a problem for us as a media. And, you know, it's a long-winded way of saying like a very short concept, which is we still don't really know. But I think abandoning our principles is not the way to go here. And being an independent, critical thinking force inside the democracy, to me, you know, the mission has never been clearer, actually, than when we've seen the kind of threats posed to independence and freedom of speech in this moment.
Right. I mean, here's the bottom line for me. Are we in the media failing institutionally in some sense to convey the gravity of the threat to the system itself that Trump poses, as expressed in his own language?
I do think that he continues to be able to brilliantly play off of our own conventions. And, you know, I see the frustrations of many, especially in the broadcast media or, you know, on television. That's very hard because of the power of images. And, you know, there is a, you know, there's a fear. These are, many of them are businesses. They're afraid of alienating a large swath of the American audience. And you know, in a way, Trump is the thing that he's very best at is as a marketer and a manipulator of the media. He understands it. That's what he does. When we did our book, The Divider, we did almost 300 interviews, many of them with people who worked very closely with Donald Trump at some point in his 4 years in office. And the single thing that really stuck with me that I don't think I fully appreciated when he was president was how much he reinvented the actual job of president. He did not really have a normal schedule of meetings and, you know, decision making and things like that. He actually watched television all day, more or less. He sat in his little dining room off the Oval Office. It wasn't just on January 6th, which we have very well documented because of the January 6th committee. It was most days. He sat in that room. He watched television. He reacted to it. He tweeted about it in this kind of constant feedback loop. And he's a creature of our news cycle and of the media.
Right. Absolutely. And it's another way. I mean, the TV watching is just another way that this is almost that this creates immense challenges for the press in terms of how to convey it, the reality of it to readers. George Conway made a point on Twitter that's germane to your argument, I think. He dismissed the idea that Trump's bloodbath language was about cars, pointing out that Trump uses apocalyptic and violent language very consistently, and he elevates everything, the fate of the auto industry or whatever else, into an argument that things are so catastrophic that only the most extreme measures will suffice. And that brings to mind your comment about this stuff really almost being more reminiscent of what a foreign correspondent would cover, right? Or encounter. And Trump packages the stuff with the thinnest veneer of plausible deniability, but we can't let that induce us to look away from what he's really saying regularly. And it just doesn't sound like an American politician. So I read Don't Look Away as a kind of wake-up call to all of us in the media as well. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it is. And I include myself in that. It is a challenge because I also very much believe that President Biden, the Democrats, they are owed our own professional, independent, critical thinking, best judgment. When any administration, it's hard not to descend into groupthink and to, you know, being inside your information bubble. And that's why we have a free press, is to make sure, that people's assumptions are challenged, that their actions are constrained by understanding what they will look like to the public. And, all of those valuable things don't go away just because we also have this enormous, even potentially existential threat from Trump. So, I do think it's important to say that. But at the same time, it is, I think George Conway is onto something there. The apocalyptic, almost, revelations like doomsday quality to what Trump is talking about. He's taken that American Carnage inaugural address, and wow, is it amped up again? The gloomy "I am your only savior" language here. And in that context, of course, it's worth noting the extraordinary flip flop and now fealty to Donald Trump that American white evangelical Christians have. They have become the center of his base. And, this is a group that I think would be uniquely susceptible to this kind of language. Donald Trump is, in effect, preaching to this choir of his that he has. I think it was over 80% of that demographic that voted for Donald Trump in 2020. And 2016 as well. Without them, he would not have been president, and he would not be a serious candidate to be president now.
Yeah, it's not easy to find any causes for optimism in what you're saying there. Well, Susan Glasser, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insights today.
Well, look, Greg, I know it can be a gloomy conversation, but I just want to say that, I still believe that paying attention matters, and that it's not a majority of the country that thinks this or that would want to believe this. And I understand that people are busy, and why do they want to spend, 2 hours on a Saturday night listening to something that's just going to be upsetting and dismaying to them? But in a way, that's the good news, because I do believe that Americans do not subscribe to the idea that they want Donald Trump to be an end of days dictator for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've actually seen that play out in the last three national elections. So, yeah. Well, thanks again, Susan. It was really terrific.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Greg.
Folks, don't miss two new pieces up at TNR.com. Michael Tomasky on why Trump's bloodbath rally was so deeply alarming, and Walter Shapiro on why Biden is unlikely to lose the election over Gaza despite the uncommitted vote against him. We'll see you all tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.